I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to take stock of what the Indiana General Assembly has and hasn't accomplished at the midway point of the 2019 legislative session. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, and Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be taking stock of what the Indiana General Assembly has and hasn't gotten accomplished at the midway point of the 2019 legislative session. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, and Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. I'd like to invite our audience. Boy, I cannot talk today. Invite our audience to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So let's just take a look at the big picture here, and then we'll drill down on some of the issues. What sort of session has it been so far? I'll start with Nikki on that one.
I think it's been pretty average. Nothing, you know, horribly crazy or scandalous. They're moving at a decent pace. They're kicking out a lot of bills, and obviously some people like that, some people don't. But I would say it's basically just an average session so far.
What's the most important thing they've done so far?
For a lot of people, it's what they did on bias crimes or hate crimes, with the Senate amending that bill to the displeasure of most of its supporters. That's certainly the thing I think that got the most attention when it happened at the State House of any one issue this session. So I'd label it that. But, of course, it's a budget year, so there's always, you know, $34 billion they're about to spend.
Well, and in some ways, because that also could be the most important thing they haven't done so far, because in many ways they kind of
depending on how you look at it.
Is what we're looking at in terms and it doesn't change the law all that much if this moves forward. I mean, it pretty much preserves the status quo, if I'm not mistaken.
The people who supported the change that the Senate made to include the words "including bias" in the current sentencing statute argue it does a lot more than current law. In that it's more inclusive and more directional for judges to use.
Well, actually, technically, they argue that it's already legal under Indiana law from a 2003 Supreme Court case. So, if you take that as their argument, then it doesn't do much more than we already have under court precedent.
Yeah, that's true.
So, Dan, what do you think is what's the session been like for you so far?
It's been busy but steady. Speaking of the budget. What struck me as interesting and what a lot of people have brought up is this idea that it doesn't specifically include money for teacher pay raises. Mm-hmm. This has been a big source of controversy this session. Teachers have suggested that they might lead a walkout or other employment action to push for higher teacher pay immediately. There is more money in the budget for Indiana schools, and the governor proposed sort of a pension trick where local school districts would pay lower rates into the state's teacher pension contribution fund, which frees up more money. But there's no requirement that money go to teachers, and teachers, I'm hearing, aren't particularly satisfied by that.
Well, and they aren't the only ones. I mean, Jennifer McCormick hasn't exactly been quiet about it as well. Is that going to be the big drama, do you think, of the second half of the session? I'll stay with you, Dan, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's not going away. Teachers are organizing an event in early March to really highlight this issue. And as important as the budget is, it only becomes more important as the session goes on when they get to the point where they're actually negotiating with real numbers and final plans. Everything to this point is somewhat preliminary. So as we get closer to the adjournment date on April 29th, there'll be a lot more pressure from presumably teachers and other groups that want to see their specific thing included in the budget.
Nikki, what do you think the chances are that this is going to blow up and become a serious battle?
I mean, technically everyone's on the same side, so I don't know if it would be a big battle. I'm fascinated by it in the sense of, you know, on most things, local schools and teachers would absolutely say, no, we don't want state mandates. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like they want lawmakers to mandate districts to give them certain pay raises, because obviously that hasn't been happening in recent years or we wouldn't have gotten to this point.
Brandon, same question to you.
You know, in terms of it being the big drama of the second half, probably that and hate crimes. But I also don't see it changing all that much. Because all of the Republican leadership, the governor, the speaker, the Senate President Pro Tem, are kind of on the same page, which is we're going to put more money in education, and that number might change as we get a look at what the real numbers, as Dan kind of put it, will be for the budget. That number might change a little bit, but the governor's plan to free up those pension dollars, that's going to go forward because everybody is a fan of that. And that's pretty much it. I mean, Republicans don't want a mandate to local schools what they should do on teacher pay raises, and I don't see that changing over the next couple of months.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the 2019 legislative session at the midway point. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So if that's the case, if you don't see you know, I mean, normally when you're talking about a walkout or something like that, the feelings are, if everybody's on the same page, what then really is the fight about, Nikki?
I mean, the fight is about the mechanism to get the pay to the teachers. You know, for history, all of history, I mean, they provide money to the K-12 formula, and then the districts decide locally what to do with that. They negotiate the contracts with teachers. So, I mean, that part isn't any different. And I don't think lawmakers really want to do it any different. They are trying to put some, I guess, bully pulpit pressure on the locals by saying, here's this chunk of money we're giving you, and we think you should give it to your teachers. And so that's what they're focusing on.
Fundamentally, it comes down to this. There are sort of three things that they're doing on teacher pay this session. The money in the budget for all of the K-12 education funding, which they're raising so far by a little over 2% in each of the next 2 years, which is roughly inflation. The House Republicans have a bill that I think the Senate Republicans are behind, that we heard from Rod Bray say that, which is that they want schools to spend 85% of those education dollars in the classroom and 15% not in the classroom. And that if schools don't hit those numbers, they're going to publish it. They're going to have to explain to the State Board of Education why they're not hitting those numbers. But it doesn't say you have to. It just says we're going to publicly shame you if you don't. And then the teacher pension thing that Dan talked about. That will help some schools. That teacher pension thing will definitely help some schools, including the biggest ones like IPS, Fort Wayne. But some schools aren't really going to see much of an impact at all from that money because they don't have as many teachers in that particular pension fund. So those are the three things they're going to do. And none of them absolutely 100% guarantee the teachers are going to get a pay raise. And nobody is saying that it will.
How much of this is a product of the fact that, you know, the education wars in this state have been going on for a long time, and there's a lot of distrust all the way through the system? How much of this is a product that most of these folks just don't trust each other, Dan?
Well, it's some of that, but also there is this national Red for Ed movement that you've seen in a lot of Republican states where teachers are coming out and saying, you know, we're not going to take it anymore. And they do these walkouts. They do these, I mean, not strikes necessarily, but they do these public actions to raise awareness. And, you know, right now it seems like everybody's cooperating. But, you know, as you get in towards late March, mid-April, things might start falling apart. You know, last session didn't fall apart until the last day of the session.
So is the threat of the walkout more just a show of force, a kind of a way to demonstrate you do have a hand to play? Nikki, you're making eye contact, so I'm going to go with you.
Oh, I found it interesting that we actually talked to the governor about that, and he said, you know, I hope they don't walk out because he thinks for the first time, you know, Republicans are on board with working with teachers and they really are trying to make that a priority. And so to have a walkout of or work disruption of any kind in a year when they are trying both in short term and long term ways to address the issue, I think they think, you know, would be a shame.
So speaking of the governor, since we introduced it, he made a little bit of news here by acknowledging that
depends what you call news.
Yeah, by acknowledging that he had smoked marijuana
in college,
but that he doesn't think it should be legalized. I think the thing that I found interesting about that is it wasn't, for those of a certain vintage, something like that would have been a huge news story. 20 years or so ago, maybe even a little longer than that. I mean, Bill Clinton, you know, still occasionally you will hear jokes about the fact that he said he tried it but didn't inhale, so it didn't count. And that, you know, I think Evan Bayh got tagged with it a little bit when he was running for governor. Why, you know, A, Nikki says if you call it a story these days, it does signal, though, a change in attitudes, because it would have been a huge story at one point. And we had a Supreme Court nominee at one point get derailed by the fact, Brandon.
The fact that the question he was asked, have you ever tried marijuana, followed on a question about medical marijuana legalization in this state and his continued lack of support for that. So Dan asked the follow-up, have you ever tried it? But the fact that we're talking in multiple press conferences with multiple leaders and have been for a year or so now seriously about medical marijuana legalization is exactly the reason that I agree with Nikki, which is I don't think the fact that Eric Holcomb smoked pot in college is that much of a story anymore, because for increasingly in society, that's not that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was worth writing an entire story about. Some people did, and that's fine. But I think it's a signal of the societal shift on that issue, which is the reason that Indiana is surrounded by three or four states that have some sort of marijuana legalization.
And it's notable that Governor Holcomb didn't equivocate when I asked him that question. He just said yes, and then I asked him when, and a few follow-ups. And he didn't hesitate at all. He just said it, unlike, you know, what Bill Clinton tried to do when he was, well, I didn't inhale, things like that.
Yeah.
So he just, yep, I did it.
Yeah, or Evan Bayh saying he tried it, but he didn't enjoy it, so it didn't count, basically. You know, is this a product of the fact, I mean, that, you know, this debate about marijuana legalization is going to continue and probably accelerate? Nikki?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been accelerating in Indiana for a while. I mean, we had a study committee on it last year. They couldn't actually come to any agreement on it, but we, you know, studied it, and obviously the bill didn't move forward this year. But it's, how many states have it now? Seven?
It's like, is it 30?
Yeah.
That
so,
have some
medicinal.
Some form of.
So yeah, I think it's just a sign of the times that it will eventually get here. But, you know, as we know, Indiana's a little slow on those type of issues.
I mean, we just legalized Sunday alcohol sales last year, so the curve is a little different.
Although Indiana's going to have to get involved in this. You know, I report on Northwest Indiana.
Yeah.
It's legal in Michigan. It's going to be legal in Illinois. And there's a lot of people who go between Illinois and Michigan on a fairly regular basis who are going to be driving through Indiana. And I don't think the Lake County Sheriff wants to arrest everybody with marijuana in their system as they currently can. If you've smoked marijuana in the last 30 days, they could pull you over for impaired driving. So Indiana law may need to change to reflect the reality of legal marijuana.
Which anticipates my next question is, when does the state begin to grapple with that in a serious way, Brandon?
Well, if you're Eric Holcomb, the answer is as soon as the feds do something with it. That's been his line for a little while now, which is, I'm not going to do anything here in Indiana, or I'm not going to support anything here in Indiana until the federal government either deschedules the drug or legalizes it in some form or does something to make it not illegal, because he's right. I mean, the states that have legalized it, whether for medicinal or recreational use, are technically in violation of federal law. It's just that the federal government so far has said, oh, whatever, do what you want.
If you are just joining us, we are taking stock of the Indiana General Assembly at the midway point of the 2019 legislative session. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, and Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the Indiana General Assembly's record so far in the 2019 legislative session. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, and Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana. So we alluded to what was probably the highest profile issue, and I want to drill down a little more on that, and that was the bias crimes or hate crimes legislation. I'd like everybody's thoughts or take on sort of where that is and where it might go from here. Brandon, you're shaking your head, so I'm going with you. Is that a way of saying no one knows?
A little bit. I think we have strong signals of where it's going to go. So to recap, we had a legislation that came down just before the committee deadline in the Senate that said that created an aggravator for sentences. So judges could consider this when deciding what the sentence for the offender would be. And it said if the crime was motivated by bias, and then it gave a list of victim characteristics that includes race, religion, national origin, and notably sexual orientation and gender identity. It passed easily out of committee after hours of testimony. Then it got to the Senate floor, and the Senate amended it by a fairly significant margin. I think it was 33-16 in favor of this amendment that took that entire – basically just took the entire bill, wiped it all away, and said judges can consider anything, including bias. Literally, the words including bias. There's two words and a comma, as Senator Tim Lannon likes to say. That was very upsetting to people who've been backing this bias crimes bill. But I'll say this, and then the Senate passed the bill a couple days later. That version, or something like it, it's not actually that exact version, but a version of that bill without a list of victim characteristics is what House Republican leadership has said all along that they are in favor of. They don't like the list, and they won't say exactly why, but the answer is, for the most part, because there's a lot of lawmakers who don't like the words gender identity because they think it's about the trans community. It is about the trans community. It's not solely about them, but it is about the trans community, and there's a lot of lawmakers who don't support that. House Republicans have said they don't want it. So where is this going to go? I don't know for sure, but I'm not sure I see a future in which House Republicans add back in a list of victim characteristics as much as so many people, including Governor Eric Holcomb, very steadfastly want to happen.
Dan.
Yeah, I thought it was notable yesterday that the governor came out and called on Hoosiers to contact their legislators respectfully and let them know that they should support a comprehensive proposal that includes a list of protected classes. That seemed pretty aggressive for this governor to be telling the people of this state to, you know, contact his fellow Republicans and tell them to advance the position that the governor wants to take rather than the position that the legislators are comfortable with. I haven't seen Governor Holcomb or many governors do that in this state to really make a public appeal on an issue that, while, say, polls show that 70% of people support having a bias crime law, it's not exactly the most salient issue for a lot of people. I mean, they think it's important, but that's not probably what's going to decide their vote. And the governor is taking it to the next level, if you will, by reaching out to them and encouraging them to call their legislators.
On the flip side, though, Nikki, he did not say that he would veto the measure in its current form, which I would think would weaken a little bit of the threat or the appeal.
I think he, is trying not to kind of negotiate in public. He did say it's too early for the V word. But obviously that's a big issue. And I think it's fascinating to watch, where Governor Holcomb's clout is. I mean, last year there was a debate on the Republican platform about the definition of gay marriage, and the conservative faction definitely beat back that, even though Eric Holcomb's sort of people had tried to loosen that a little. And I think we're seeing kind of the same, fight going on now, because while no one does want to talk about sexual orientation or gender identity, that's the undercurrent. The undercurrent is things like race and religion and where you were born can't be changed. But there are some people in the Republican Party who feel that sexual orientation and gender identity are not, quote, immutable.
Mm-hmm. As we've talked to Governor Holcomb and some of his folks about that, about what Nikki just talked about, he lost a battle with involving a lot of the same people and over kind of the same issue, not exactly the same issue, but a similar issue in the gay marriage platform debate. The governor's argument and folks on his team, their argument has been, well, this is a different audience. It's hard to win that fight in the Republican Party's convention. But this is a fight among the state of Indiana, broadly among Hoosiers. But it's not really. It's that fight is with the Republican caucus in the House and the Senate. And that's pretty much the same thing as the Republican convention. It really is. And so, again, I don't know for sure where this is going to go. But I have a pretty good feeling, because we have significant evidence to suggest the governor just can't win this one.
Go ahead, Nikki.
To be fair, also, I was going to point out, they are trying to make it economic. Mm-hmm. A large swath of Indiana's major business
community. And that's where I wanted to go with this, is that it's got some interesting divisions within.
Is on board for this. The Chamber of Commerce is behind it. The line of major employers that testified at that Senate hearing was, very impressive. And yet they don't seem to be winning the argument. I mean, they're saying, look, we don't need anything that makes us look unwelcoming at all. Like, we're struggling with, low unemployment. We're struggling filling positions. We're struggling getting talent to want to come here. Yeah. And even if this is just one tiny little thing, we need to change it so that we can move forward.
Well, and I guess that's where I wanted to go with this, because it sounds like what we're seeing is, for those of us who have been around for a while, there were a lot of people writing kind of obituaries for social conservatives in this state after Mitch Daniels took out Eric Miller in the 2004 gubernatorial primary, and that it was, at least among the Republican Party, it was, okay, it's now the Chamber's party, and they're going to be driving things, business community's party. And clearly what we're seeing now is that in a battle between, the business community and social conservatives, often it is the social conservatives who are winning. Dan.
Yeah, definitely, especially in the Senate. The Senate has really become the focal point of that. A lot of the old guard business conservatives have, retired or left the scene. You think of people like Luke Kenley or Brandt Hirschman.
Or even arguably David Long.
Mm-hmm. And some of their replacements are more in the social conservative mold. And it's starting to show within the Senate Republican caucus, which also has a new leader who's maybe struggling to sort of rein in some of those impulses that don't always sit well with the state's business community.
But again, as I try to look to what has happened before to read the tea leaves on what might happen going forward, the chamber has had a lot of success since Republicans have controlled state government in advancing their agenda. But if you look at the things they've gotten, I can't find hardly any that Republicans in general didn't already support. Things like right to work, things like tax cuts, business tax cuts in particular. Like, those are all check. I mean, they didn't have to put the screws to Republicans to get a business tax cut, the corporate income tax cut.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing, though, is when the interests of the business community and the interests of social conservatives come into conflict, it seems to be inevitably that the social conservatives prevail. Nikki's making.
I think that's what we've seen so far. And we'll see in the second half if the governor and those business communities, I mean, House Speaker Brian Bosma was joking with us when we talked to him on Wednesday or Tuesday that, you know, someone had given his cell phone number out and he spent a lot of time on the over the weekend talking to business CEOs who were calling him to state their case.
But it's not even the business community versus social conservatives where the business community hasn't had victories. You think of something like the cigarette tax. And raising the age, the minimum age to buy tobacco. The chamber's been pushing that for years, and they haven't gotten anywhere. And it's not religious conservatives on the other side of that one. It's just that that's not particularly popular with Republicans. So when they try to advance anything that doesn't have broad support in the GOP, or at least in the GOP caucuses, they're just not winning very much.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Indiana General Assembly and where it stands at the halfway point of the 2019 legislative session. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or do what a listener named David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, John. I'm a regular listener. Enjoy all your shows.
Had a couple
comments, and I'll go ahead and get off the phone and listen. My first comment is about the bias law. We wouldn't need to add all these things into it. The prosecutors would simply do the right thing, and that's everybody does the same thing. Unfortunately, there have been lots of exceptions made that have caused us to have to add the bias themes of gender, race, religion, and so on and so forth. If we could just get everybody to get on the same page and do the right thing, which is not definitively defined, that would make it much easier to legislate a law that would handle hate crimes. Secondly, if this legislature can't figure out a way to get our teachers paid better, we are going to continue the bleeding loss of teachers we've seen over the many years. That they have been unwilling to do anything about teachers' pay. I'll go ahead and get off the phone and listen for commentary.
Certainly. Thanks very much for the call, David.
You're very welcome.
Dan, I'll let you start.
I'll respond to one thing on the teacher pay, which is, you know, this is not an Indiana-only issue. This same conversation is happening all across the U.S. The teaching profession has lost people who want to go into teaching for more than just money. You know, high stakes testing and those kinds of things. So this is obviously not just a Republican Indiana legislature problem.
How much of this, though, is, in part because you're alluding to that, when I talk with teachers, you know, they'll complain about the pay. But if you really drill down, it's much more about we don't feel like we're respected or we're valued anymore. So this pay question seems to have taken on a symbolic weight that is difficult to address in tangible measures like legislation. Dan?
Yeah, and some of that in Indiana goes back, two superintendents to Tony Bennett, who really made teachers sort of the focus of his school reform efforts and saying that teachers weren't doing good enough, so we need to create these charter schools, we need to create these private school vouchers to let the kids go anywhere, and then came up with an A through F school grading system that most legislators don't even understand, that changes every couple of years. But if you're working in a school that the state every year is saying, oh, you're a D school, you're not going to be very happy with your job.
Yeah, and then you add to that the teacher collective bargaining that was significantly curtailed by the legislature several years ago now.
Mm-hmm. So is there a way to address that problem in the scope of this current debate, or is it something that's likely just to continue being exacerbated?
I mean, Jennifer McCormick, the state superintendent, has, who is a Republican, who put forward a pretty broad agenda this year to try and improve the position of teachers and the you know, work happiness of teachers, in addition to raising teacher pay, and that really went nowhere. In fact, they're going to get rid of her position, make it a governor-appointed position, so it almost backfired. But yeah, there just doesn't seem to be much appetite or interest in, you know, taking those steps that would make these people, you know, feel more appreciated or respected in their jobs.
And Dan mentioned, you know, how the school evaluation system has seemingly been changing every couple of years. They're changing it again, or at least they're proposing to change it again. So if you felt fatigued by it already, that's not letting up anytime soon.
Well, that's been one of the concerns I've often heard, too, is it's not just the school evaluation or even the teacher evaluation. It's all of the standardized testing. You know, they changed the test. I think at one point I took a look and the test had been in existence. This is back in the ISTEP days for 21 years. And in that time, it had actually been changed 23 times. So, you know, which to my unsophisticated mind, I thought part of the point of having a standard was that it would stay standard, that you had a measure to operate by. Is there... we alluded to the Jennifer McCormick situation. I talked with her the night of the State of the State, and when she was talking about the governor, you could just feel the temperature drop about 25 degrees. Is there any hope that they're going to get on anything resembling the same page? Okay, Brandon's shaking his head. Nikki is just pursing her lips.
No, they're not. That she has never been in lockstep with Republicans at the State House since she was elected. She felt, I think, or my sense was that she felt she wasn't very supported in her election. And most people didn't think she was going to win. And honestly, I think she probably in part rode the Trump wave to that election upset victory over Glenda Ritz, the Democrat. So she didn't feel particularly supported in the campaign. She's never really been in lockstep with them at the State House since she took office. Arguably, position-wise, she had a lot more in common with Glenda Ritz than she does with Republicans at the State House. Mm-hmm. And since she's announced that she's not going to run for re-election in 2020, there's no reason for her to play nice in that sense. She's going to say what she thinks. And because for her, what are the consequences? They were already going to basically take away her job.
What I'm curious about, though, is where we go from here, because it seems like there's a tremendous amount of frustration that teachers, professional educators, don't feel like they've got a voice in the system. And now you take away the one place where they thought they were being heard, the one office. Is that just going to escalate the frustrations, Nikki?
Yeah, I honestly have no idea. Maybe that's why we're hearing some of this walkout talk this year more than other years. Maybe they've just kind of hit their toleration level.
Damn.
Well, and it's going to make the governor's race more important. Mm-hmm. So you get rid of the superintendent on the ballot. The 2020 governor's race is, at least half of the race is about education, because the governor's going to be appointing the new superintendent. I'm not sure Eric Holcomb is prepared for that kind of focus on education, because some of his friends in the General Assembly have been pushing through a lot of policies that he's now going to have to answer for, because he's in charge of all the state's schools.
The question will be, yeah, is it, though? Like, that's an argument, but the question will be, will that actually be what happens? Will the governor's race become a focal point for education or not? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there's obviously that potential now, but I'm not sure it will be. And there's an argument to be made that Eric Holcomb might hope it isn't.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the how the Indiana legislature is doing at the 2019, during the 2019 legislative session as we've hit the midway point. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, and Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do it in several ways. You can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about how the Indiana General Assembly has done now that we have hit the halfway point of the 2019 legislative session. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, and Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana. Okay, so we've talked about the big ticket items here. What have been? Have there been any kind of small surprises? Things that have popped up that no one could have anticipated. Anything, and I see a lot of furrowed brows here, so there's nothing. Brandon.
Let me take this way of talking about it. One of the biggest issues that we haven't talked about yet on the show is the big gaming bill that's moving through the Senate. I suppose the surprise of that is it's mostly been relatively easy. Mm-hmm. It's sailed through the committees it's been in, albeit with changes and then undoing all of those changes, but it sailed through the House floor. Now we'll see what it's like in the House. The House has traditionally been not as happy to jump in with both feet on some gaming stuff. But I mean, we're talking about a huge sea change in Indiana's gambling industry with possibly a new casino opening in Terre Haute, with sports wagering for the first time in the state since last year's Supreme Court decision legalized it across the country. And yet, it's just kind of flowing through without much.
Yeah, it's pretty under the radar. I mean, coming into session, I thought the sports betting would be, you know, quite a debate. But it's like basically yawn, you know. Everyone says, oh, they're already doing it anyway online, you know, offshore illegal sites. So what's it matter if we offer it to and get a few tax dollars? So, yeah, surprising-wise, you know, it's just sort of moving right through with no real problems. I mean, I could probably hazard a guess at a 78-22 House vote on it.
Sports wagering?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you the gaming stuff has been getting a ton of attention in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, because of, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about two Gary casino licenses. There's one casino in Gary that's operated under two licenses. So the plan would move one of those licenses to Interstate 8094. Off of Lake Michigan, create a $300 million land-based casino there, and then send the second one to Terre Haute. There's been a lot of concern from the other casino communities in Northwest Indiana, Hammond, East Chicago, Michigan City, that putting the Gary Casino in a more advantageous location, because it's kind of hard to get up to Lake Michigan to get to these casinos, would hurt their revenue. So the Senate had to put a hold harmless in there so those casino communities other than Gary wouldn't lose their gaming tax revenue once the new Gary casino opens for 3 years. So it's so it seems to be sailing through down here, and there hasn't been anything that would blow it up, but very specific parts of it have been the source of a lot of controversy in Northwest Indiana.
Well, and what is the controversy? Is it that competition, or is it the fact that they're going to lose one that's going over to Terre Haute?
Yeah, nobody seems to mind giving one up because it really, the Majestic Star Casino really operates as one casino, even though for all legal and technical purposes, it's technically two.
And tax purposes.
But what the people in Gary want to focus on is not the move of the casino, but what happens to Buffington Harbor on Lake Michigan after the casino is moved. So in addition to this gaming bill, there's also Senate Bill 66, which would create what they're calling a compact between the state and the city to redevelop this huge lakefront area in Gary into an intermodal transit facility. There's three Class 1 rail lines that run through there. The Gary Airport is right there. There's a bunch of highways right there. You've got Lake Michigan. They want to turn it into a shipping alternative to Chicago. So trains and boats and cars would drop their stuff or warehouse their stuff in Gary rather than having to go all the way into Chicago. And leaders in Gary think this is going to create, you know, a ton of jobs, a ton of opportunity, almost a rebirth for the city if the casinos are able to move out of there and then if this development follows.
How much of this with the rest of the state? We can see, obviously, the region's interest in this is a concern for those of us who have long memories, at least part of the state's historic opposition to gambling, to legalized gambling, dissolved, you know, nearly 30 years ago because there was an awareness of just how many dollars were leaving the state, that this is also an attempt to try to capture some of that revenue. Nikki, you started the discussion, or is that a...
I mean, just in general, I mean, that the gambling debate isn't what it used to be. Mm-mm. It used to be, you know, much more contentious. I mean, really, once you get inside the gambling debate, it's always about when you change, you know, X policy here, it helps the casino in this town and hurts the casino in this town. You know, moving a casino to Terre Haute sounds great for Terre Haute, but does it hurt the Evansville casino? Does it hurt the French Lick casino? Those are existing businesses with employees that are already there. So those are the kinds of discussions that are going on that. There's always a small group of legislators who don't vote for any gambling bills, and those people are still there. But I think everyone has realized we're so far down the gambling rabbit hole that, I mean, you know, that there's not any sort of coordinated opposition anymore.
And we had this conversation with Brian Bosman just on Tuesday in our little press conference after the session, halfway point, which was we asked the question, because he defines this bill as a major expansion of gaming, and it's hard to argue that. As much as, yes, it's not a new license, but in all effects, it is, in many ways, a new license for the state because it's a completely separate facility somewhere else. He considers that a major expansion of gaming. And that used to be a red line for a lot of lawmakers, not just a few. A lot of lawmakers would balk at that kind of big change. But that's just not the case anymore. Nikki's right. I mean, things have changed. We've gotten more comfortable with it, especially as all of our surrounding states, or for most of the surrounding states, have multiple casinos near the border, so that it's a way of life at this point.
Well, and that's sort of where I was going with this, because it sounds like, you know, there are disputes at the local level about, even here in Indianapolis, about where a grocery store should open, because it might take business from another one. Have we gotten to the point where basically gambling is just like any other business in this state, and that it's really about, okay, regulating territories or spheres of influence? Dan?
I don't think it is. If any other industry employed 10,000 people and wanted to open a new location, the state would be throwing money at them, especially if they were paying a 35% tax rate. You know, I mean, this is an industry that employs 10,000 people. It produces $400 million or more in state and local tax revenue every year. And all we ever do is hobble it by you saying, you know, you can only do this. You can only do it in these places. You can only do it at this time.
You can only have so many games.
Yeah, it's remarkable that we've just sort of allowed this industry to wither over the last, well, especially during the Pence administration, but even the Holcomb administration hasn't done that much to prop it up in the face of new competition from Ohio, slots and bars in Illinois. A lot of people see this as a chance to revive the industry in some way, especially the Gary Casino being on an interstate. You can get those people who are used to going to their local bar in Illinois playing those five slot machines and say, oh, maybe I'll go to a casino.
I would think it would be really interesting. One way to see exactly how far the gambling debate has gone in Indiana is if there was ever an attempt to add licenses, you know, like actually increase the number of licenses, maybe put one in Indy. I think then that would be really interesting to see how much of a shift there's been, or if there's still sort of a red line somewhere there.
Yeah, that one would not be sailing through the General Assembly like this one is.
But it's interesting that we have all these casinos in somewhat inconvenient places. So you don't have a casino in Indianapolis.
But they're purposely near the borders. And right. the idea is, and at this point, because the industry has been around for so long, when they're talking about adding a new one in Terre Haute that's not really close to any of the others, it's kind of an out-of-way place. But that's because they're trying not – I mean, if you put a casino in Indianapolis – you're going to take business not from Illinois and Michigan and Ohio. You're going to take business from Anderson and Shelbyville and French Lick.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you could put one in Fort Wayne.
Apparently Fort Wayne's not interesting.
I think we're kind of saturated.
Well, and it shows how this is, and you're sort of making addressing the point, because in the old days, they actually had to be on the water. I mean, it was a really kind of strange system.
We're well over the water now.
Yeah. That ship has sailed to abuse. So let's switch subjects here a little bit. What for this session? What has been the biggest missed opportunity? A problem that is out there that the state could have addressed, or an opportunity that it could have taken advantage of, and it hasn't seized upon. Brandon,
again, this is all a matter of perspective, but you could argue that a missed opportunity is not trying to pass a cigarette tax increase. We haven't increased the cigarette tax in more than a decade, I want to say.
2008, maybe?
Yeah, so about a decade. And that represents a couple of things. One, it's money. In the short term, it would be money, and depending on how much you increase the cigarette tax, quite a bit of money for the state. But long term, it's about the health of the state. Study after study after study after study shows you that when you increase the price of cigarettes, which this would do, you are going to stop people from starting or help people quit. And that isn't just about health. It is about health. But it's also about, we're going to save the state money over the long term because our citizens will be a little healthier. We are an unhealthy state by almost every measure. And one of those measures is smoking. Our smoking rate is high. Mm-hmm. So if you reduce our smoking rate, you are going to lessen the cost to the state in all sorts of ways.
Also in the eye of the beholder realm, I mean, because again, missed opportunity is very subjective. But I think a lot of people are disappointed that we are flatlining funding for pre-K. We're still doing this pilot program. We just, even though it's been around for, what, 4, 5, 6 years now, it seems like, you know, there's no movement to make that available in a consistent way to all Hoosier children.
Dan.
Similar to what Nikki said, there doesn't seem to be much of a overall push to make Indiana anything more than it is. Everybody seems satisfied with good enough, and as long as things can just keep going as they are, nobody's really setting a higher bar for Hoosiers to aspire to. It's just, let's keep things where they are. We'll keep our budget surplus. We'll keep our $2 billion in the bank. Just let's keep everything normal, and maybe nobody will notice us, and we won't cause any problems.
How much of this is a product? I mean, Indiana has been led by Republican governors now for the past 15 years. This is the third or fourth session in which Republicans have had super majorities in both chambers of the legislature. Glenda Ritz was like the one blip in terms of statewide office holders. How much of this is a product of the fact that the Republican Party, at least in all the big ticket items, the things they really wanted, they've already got them. They got them several years ago. Nikki?
Yeah, I mean, they've made, a lot of progress on their agenda items. You know, we have a pretty solid road funding infrastructure plan in place. We have, obviously a great business tax climate that they've built for, more than a decade. And so I do think there are fewer sort of big ticket opportunities out there to make, massive, bold changes.
The struggle here, I think, going forward, especially if it continues to be led by Republicans and even Republican supermajorities in the legislature, is going to be that they have created inarguably an incredible business tax climate. It's why we see a lot of companies locating or expanding in Indiana. There's no argument about that. But the problem is that a lot of site selectors will tell you that increasingly the conversation isn't just about business tax climate, because a lot of states have done that. It's about this issue of quality of place. What is the lifestyle mm-hmm. here? Why are my workers going to want to come to Indiana or be in Indiana to come work for my company, the workers that I absolutely need? And some of that, something like a bias crimes law, something like we saw a few years ago, a civil rights code mm-hmm. that's more inclusive. That's the stuff that the Republican supermajorities have struggled to get any traction on. And it's increasingly the watchword of economic development. So what's going to happen in a few years' time when increasingly that's where Indiana perhaps starts to fall behind?
Dan.
I mean, Northwest Indiana did get you a national park. So
that's true. In all seriousness, that's the sort of stuff we're talking about. That's exactly the sort of stuff we're talking about. It's not what's your corporate tax level. It's we don't have, yeah. you know, people say Indiana doesn't have mountains. It doesn't have oceans. What is it going to do to make itself more attractive?
And it seems like a lot of the issues that are here now don't have that clear. I think Brandon earlier in the program, but everybody agreed with it, said many of the issues are that sail through are the ones that all Republicans like. But
and not just Republicans, to be fair. I mean, but, most of the stuff we pass is pretty bipartisan.
Well, but my point would be that a lot of the issues now that are out there, like bias crimes, teacher pay, there are honest divisions of opinion about, and they don't necessarily fall along party lines either. Right, Nikki?
Yeah, sometimes that happens. I mean, one area we haven't seen a lot of movement on, obviously we got Sunday sales last year, but, you know, we still see divisions on, you know, how strict we need to be on alcohol laws. I think I lost my train of thought there.
So let me ask this. We've got just a little bit of time here. You know, are there going to be any surprises in this last half of the session, or is it going to grind to a pretty predictable end? And are they going to get everything done this time? Dan.
That's always the situation. You think things are just going along swimmingly, and then suddenly it's 11 o'clock on the last night of session, and there's 10 other bills still out there that they haven't worked on yet. So, and then there's always the after party, and who knows what will happen with various state officials. So just when you think it's going to be a normal session, something always seems to come along and surprise you.
Nikki.
Keep an eye out for some movement on a payday lending issue mm-hmm. that's been popping up and getting really focused on in the Senate. That's one that I would say keep an eye out for.
Brandon. What I'm watching for is what the governor will do on hate crimes. How is he going to amp up the pressure?
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, and Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana for what has been a lively conversation about the Indiana General Assembly. As always, I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in and for lending some great questions and comments. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.